All right, Abraham's seed, again, just reminding us, we often don't think of ourselves as Abraham's seed. We think of ourselves as Christians. We think of ourselves as in God's family, but Paul felt it important enough to at least tell the Galatian believers, you already are Abraham's seed. And what we're doing is trying to see, what does that mean for us in our lives? The family of promise, that's a very important phrase. And we're kind of working on that. Hopefully you're seeing that. Tonight, kind of getting to the halfway point, Ishmael and circumcision, verses chapter 16 and 17. So where we've been, so Genesis 1 through 11, again, I view that as the preface of Scripture. It's where certain themes are set, certain melody is set. We've talked about melody a lot, the narrative story that works through the Bible, and recognize that that melody sometimes drops kind of down low and other events are highlighted, but the melody is always there. And really, as we work through Scripture, recognize the melody. If we start wanting to understand certain doctrines, certain things, those don't ever really contradict the melody. The melody is what helps us understand who God is, how our response to Him is. So within the first 11 chapters, we see a series of rebellions culminates in Babel. We see Babel and Babylon all through the Old Testament. We see it in Revelation. It goes that image of Babylon as an authority, as an oppression. That image continues all the way through Revelation. And what we see is, and I see that again as kind of the culmination of 1 through 11 after a series of rebellions and failures. And that then gives us a sense of why Abraham. Abraham is the response to Babylon. Abraham is how God is responding to Babylon. And with that, Abraham is called. He's called to be a blessing. He is called to leave his land, his kin, and his home. God will give him a nation, a blessing, a great name, as opposed to Babylon, that they wanted to create a great name for themselves. And then we see him with this great call, and he goes to Egypt, and we see a failure there. He lies, and escapes with a lot of wealth and a lot of stuff. We then see Abram going back, kind of retracing his steps back to Bethel. God reaffirms the covenant to him. He and Lot separate, so now a part of the heir question, the heir is always, that's been a big question. Who's the seed of the woman? Who's the heir for Abraham? Who's the seed? The seed is an important theme that we're looking at. And now he knows, well, Lot's not the seed because they separate. He gets into a fight, or at least he goes and rescues Lot. And we see his military prowess, and we see God working with Abram in that encounter. And we have this encounter with Melchizedek, where we're introduced to him. We then had God's promise clarified for the heir. We know that the heir at this point in the narrative, who is the heir coming from? Abraham. And that's all God says. So then we see that Abraham trusts God, and that trust is recognized as Zedekah. And again, if we look at our triangle, Zedekah is the right response to God's promise. That's Zedekah is simply the right action, the appropriate response, the faith response. It is an action. It is not a status. Abraham is not being called righteous. Abraham, what God says is, your act of trusting is Zedekah. And I I'm wanting us to use those terms, look at those terms, because our term of righteousness has a certain definition to it, and that's not what the Scripture is saying. I'm not saying Abraham is called righteous. He's saying your action is what Zedekah looks like. And then we had this covenant ceremony. Remember that, the cutting of the pieces? And that was in response to Abraham saying, you know, I trust you, but I'd sure like some assurance. I'd just like something to hang on to. And God says, sure, no problem. God asks Abram to get some animals. Abram knows, I know where that's going. So he splits them in half, and we have God walking through the pieces. And what we looked at last week, or we talked about last week, was that the covenant is bilateral in expectations. God committed to certain things. Abraham committed to certain things. We know Abraham committed to those certain things because he obeyed. He said, I know where this is going. He gets the animals. He splits the animals. He guards the animals. So it is bilateral in expectations. It is unilateral in who bears the cost. And that's the key point. And often we hear this covenant is unilateral. It is. That is exactly right. But it is in who bears the cost if there's covenant failure. So God has basically said, I will guarantee this promise will be secure. It is all on me to guarantee the promise. And thus, that's why in the title of the class, we are the family of promise, because God has guaranteed that. It doesn't mean that there was no obligation on Abraham's part or his seed. If there was no obligation on Abraham's part or his seed, then there's really no cost, right? There's no way for the covenant to fail. We saw many ways the covenant could fail. And we're going to see another way tonight, okay? So that's where we get to. And we also talked about baptism being for us a similar sign, a similar anchor that we can hold on to. So as Abraham goes through these next several years and there is no heir, Sarah is still barren, he can still go back to that night, hang on to it, and say, I've got a surety for God's promise. Just like we, if we have a dark time, we can go back to our baptism and say, I can hang on to God's promise. It's that gift of assurance that he's given us. So where we're going tonight, we have Hagar and Ishmael. We have God sealing the covenant sign of circumcision, and the promise heir identified. Some things to look for. Again, we're relying upon the triangle to kind of help give us a framework. I hope you're using that outside of class. I hope you're using it maybe as we go through Mark to just kind of say, okay, where's Mishpat and Zedekah in Jesus' life? And again, I hope you're using it in your studies and as we work through certain gospels. Again, it's simply a framework to be able to give certain characteristics or to see us how the gospel is framed. Again, I'm not saying this is the end all, but I think it does provide us with a baseline, a way to look at stories, look at narratives, ask questions and see, okay, what's the story trying to tell us? So tonight, we can ask, where does Mishpat collapse? How is power misused? Mishpat is a power word. Okay, so think of power or authority when you're thinking of Mishpat. And it is either power or authority that is restrained or used in a way to protect the vulnerable. So sometimes I may have the authority, but I don't use it to protect someone. That is Mishpat collapsing. Where is Zedekah needed? So whose dignity? Zedekah has to do with dignity, restoration. Where is that diminished? Where is Kesed tested? Who's at the risk of being discarded? Remember, a Kesed, a love that will not abandon. And maybe we see where is love not abandoned. We may see that tonight. And where is the shalom or the promise threatened, and how does God preserve it? So just again, some questions or things to be thinking of as we move through the narrative. Genesis 16, if we want to kind of turn there, read along. Now Sarah, Abram's wife, had not borne him children. She had an Egyptian slave girl. Her name was Hagar. Sarah said to Abram, "Now hear, Yahweh has obstructed or restrained me from bearing. Pray, come to my slave girl. Perhaps I may be built up with sons through her." Abram hearkened to Sarah's voice. Sarah, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian woman, her slave girl. In parenthetical note, at the end of 10 years of Abram's being settled in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband Abram as a wife or Isha for him. So here we're reminded of the threat to the promise, right? And that threat is Sarah's still barren. So now we see, okay, we know it's coming through Abraham. That part was revealed in the prior chapter. So what sounds good? Since I can't have kids, well, Hagar looks like a nice solution. And what the story is telling us is that Abram is really going back to Egypt, because Egypt is the land of fertility. That's where you go in a time of famine. It's where Abram went in a time of famine. And here the fertility of Egypt is kind of coming back. And we see this as a bit of a consequence of Abram's decision back in Egypt the first time. It was not wrong for Abram to go to Egypt when the famine hit. The lack of trust was saying that Sarah was his sister, and Pharaoh going, okay. And then what happened? Abram got a lot of stuff, and some of that stuff was probably Hagar, because it says he got maidservants and animals and all sorts of stuff. So now we see some of that stuff becoming not a good solution. So this is a consequence. She is described as an Egyptian slave girl, so we're seeing she is an outsider. We're seeing her status as a slave girl. We're seeing she's a woman. So already we're getting some classifications that kind of let us know where her status is. We're given her name, but notice how she is referred to by Sarah. Sarah, call her by name. Oh, it's slave girl. Some of your translations will probably say handmaiden. That's probably a little soft, a little bit of, let's ease this. Slave girl is probably more the right term there. It's wanting us to let us know possession, not person. We see Sarah justifying this. It's really God's fault. So let's justify the action by selecting Hagar. Here's the important point, is that in verse 3, the text tells us that Sarah, Abram's wife, in the Hebrews Isha, gives Hagar, and at the very end it says, as a wife. Some of your versions may say concubine. Again, there's a different word for concubine. And concubine, again, is trying to soften the story a little bit. Hagar is promoted or given the status of wife. Not the primary wife, but the secondary wife. But still, it is a status of wife, and that's going to come into play. He came into Hagar, and she became pregnant. But when she saw, or Hagar saw that she was pregnant, her mistress became of light worth in her eyes. Sarah said to Abram, "The wrong done me is upon you. I gave you my slave girl into your embrace, but now that she sees she is pregnant, I have become of light worth in her eyes. May Yahweh judge what is done between me and you." Abram said to Sarah, "Here, your slave girl is in your hand. Deal with her however you seems good in your eyes." Sarah afflicted her, so that she had to escape from her. So now, again, we're in an honor-shame society. Sarah is bearing shame because she can't have children. That's just reality. So she has that shame. And now, all of a sudden, what seemed like a really cool idea has now been flipped because, well, it's pretty apparent at this point the not having children is not Abraham's fault. That's been made clear. And now all of a sudden, this slave girl is going to bear a child. So she now has the honor, and Sarah has even more shame because now it's real obvious. And so within the social structure of the family, we've got this conflict because of this solution that's now kind of spiraling out of control. So we have a shame situation happening because she was promoted to a wife. So I'm not faulting Hagar a lot here. It's like, look, you put me in this position, but we now have this distress. And she says to Abram, the wrong, the word used is Hamas. We hear that term in our modern culture. It's violence. The last time we heard that term was in relationship to the pre-flood. There was Hamas upon the earth. I don't think the author is wanting to imply there was that much violence, but the author is shocking us a little bit by saying there's really not right here. It's not right. And Sarah is making a very exaggerated claim because Sarah's basically saying, Abraham, it's your fault, right? She's blaming Abraham. And in verse, and again, she says, you know, let God judge between us. Now, verse 5.5, Abram says, woman, it was your idea, and you gave her to me, so why are you jumping on me? But actually in verse 6, Abraham just said that to himself, and he really says, well, you know, I'm going to wash my hands. You just do what you think is right. She's your slave girl. I'm done. And Sarah afflicts her. So what we see is that a person becomes a possession. In your hand indicates control. And the do what is good in your eyes is really a self-justifying. So what has happened to the triangle? It's totally collapsed, right? Abram has the power to protect the vulnerable. What needs to happen is a restoration of dignity. And what we have is a complete lack of shalom. There is no chesed in here at all. So we see within this narrative here, the triangle has just totally collapsed. What Abram was called to do, to be a blessing, and the way you be a blessing is you do this, has now once again collapsed. And with that, Sarah has afflicted her and Hagar leaves. And again, what we have here is a little bit of a foreshadowing. We have a Hebrew afflicting an Egyptian, and the Egyptian fleeing. What will we have later? We'll have an Egyptian afflicting the Hebrew. Right, so we have this little play here. Through the lens of the triangle, Mishpat is supposed to name people and restrain power that says, I will not harm you. Zedekiah is supposed to restore dignity, that you are not reducible to your status. And Kesed is supposed to hold the vulnerable in loyalty that says, you're safe with me. If we continue on, verse 7, Yahweh's messenger found her by a spring of water in the wilderness by the spring on the way to Shur. He said, Hagar, Sarah's slave girl, where do you come from and where are you going? She said, I'm fleeing my Sarah, my mistress. Yahweh's messenger said to her, return to your mistress and let yourself be afflicted under her hand. And Yahweh's messenger said to her, I will make your seed many, yes, many. It will be too many to count. And Yahweh's messenger said to her, here, you are pregnant. You will bear a son. Call his name Yishmael, for God has hearkened to your being afflicted. We have the story now of a woman at a well. And that's going to set the theme for several more stories in the Old Testament, in Genesis. But it's also going to come to mind some stories in the New Testament, right? So when we see this story, as we read through this narrative, as New Testament readers listen to the story of Jesus at a well with a Samaritan woman, we read that story kind of independent of the Old Testament. It's just a narrative within the gospel story. But I think what the author is doing is framing this so that as we read the story of the Samaritan woman, what is playing in the background in our minds is the story of Hagar and the messenger here. So kind of let both of those stories play along. Because what we see is we see a woman who is lost her dignity, a woman who is vulnerable, and we see that vulnerability recognized, seen, heard, and lifted up. And a lot of times we have a criticism of the Samaritan woman. And I don't see that. I see it alongside here. I see God responding, Jesus responding to the woman at the well, same way the angel responds to Hagar here. So just kind of keep those stories playing together. Notice he calls her by name, Hagar. But he also recognizes the truth. And what is the truth? You're still Sarah's slave girl. It's not the emphasis, but it is the truth. And it allows Hagar to answer the question honestly. Where are you going? What are you doing here? Because if the angel says Hagar and then asks the question, what's the tendency? Tendency would be to say, you know, I'm just kind of heading back to Egypt. Time to go home. There would be a tendency to hide the reality. But because the angel has named her as Sarah's slave girl, Hagar now can be honest in her response. I'm fleeing from Sarah. I can't hide this. That's what's going on. And the messenger gives her what seems to be us of a very odd response, right? Go back and, you know, just you're going to be afflicted. And sometimes that's just the way things are. And perhaps it's because, again, Shur is on the way to Egypt, so we know she's going home. That's the direction she's going. And it could be that the angel's saying, you know, if you think it's going to be better for you in Egypt, it's not. You're a single mom with a foreign-born dad. That it's not going to work well for you in Egypt. You're not going to have acceptance there. Go back under Abraham's care. And yes, you'll be afflicted, but here's the but. I will make your seed many. It will be too many to count. Have we heard that before? So her linkage to Abraham, Abraham is the father. And what the angel is saying is, you know, I've made Abraham a promise that his seed will be many. You are not the covenant line. But I still will bless you through Abraham. So God is blessing Hagar simply because of the relationship with Abraham. And he's using similar seed language. And it's one of the few women who's talked about your seed. Most of the time, your seed is language spoken to the man. But here, that language is spoken to the woman. He says, call your son's name Yishmael. God hears. And we've heard the term Shema, right? I think we've all heard that term. We've heard the Shema. Hear, O Israel. The reason it's called Shema? Well, the first word is hear, and in Hebrew, that's Shema. That's the only reason it's called that. That's the first word. And we can hear that in Yishmaya, Yishma, out. God hears. And the irony of that is every time Abraham calls his son's name, he's recognizing that God hears. And that's going to be a reminder for Abraham for the next 13 years. God has heard your being afflicted. And this is chesed, right? This is God's chesed. God says, I hear your affliction. God understands affliction, and he responds to that. And that is one of the key lessons to this. He says of Ishmael, he shall be a wild ass of a man, his hand against all, hand of all against him. He will encamp in despite of or over against all his kin. Now she called the name of Yahweh, the one who was speaking to her, you are the God of seeing, El Roy. For she said, have I actually gone on seeing here after his seeing me? Therefore, the well was called Well of the Living One Who Sees Me. Here it is between Kadesh and Bered. Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of the son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. Abram was 80 years and 6 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. The comment that he will be a wild donkey or a wild ass of a man, we look at that and think, that just wasn't very nice. Okay? I just really wouldn't.
It's an accurate prediction.
Tim, if you call me that, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. But it's just not a term we would think of as being complimentary. Let's move this back into their culture. What is Hagar? She's the slave girl. Okay. What is a wild donkey? A wild donkey's free. So what's the angel telling Hagar? Ishmael's not going to be the servant. He's not going to be a slave. He's going to live as a free man. This is, what encouragement could a slave have to know that the son I'm going to deliver is not going to be a slave? He's going to be free. And yes, there's going to be conflict, there's going to be tension, but he will be free. And I'm for me, I'm thinking Hagar took that and just that was just a sign of relief. And she calls God the God of seeing. This is the only instance in the Old Testament of anybody giving God a name. And it is an Egyptian slave girl who names God as the God who sees. And we've noticed this term throughout Scripture.
So I like your connection there. I've never thought about it that way. But is there a connection also to the next part of his hand against all, hand of all against him with this wild ass of a man?
Only in that he will be free. We know nations will come from him. He will have many. But that there's just going to be tension. is really the best I could give. The phrase, he will encamp in despite of, over against them, from what I read, most of the Hebrew scholars go, I don't know, that's the best guess. So it seems to indicate tension, not necessarily one serving the other, but just a tension that's going to be there, but not necessarily servitude.
So you think those are two separate thoughts, not two connected thoughts?
I think they're connected. I think there's tension going both ways. So what you're thinking?
Well, so I've always read that of, you know, he will be, where's that?
Verse 12 in mind.
Yeah. All right. So in mind, this son of yours will be a wild man, as untamed as a donkey. He will raise his fists against everyone, and everyone will be against him. So I guess my question is that you're saying he will be wild means he will be free.
Yes.
Never thought of it that way. But then the very next sentence is he will raise his fists against everyone. So I guess my question is, are those two thoughts connected, or are they two separate?
I think separate.
Okay.
So yeah, I think this is describing his freedom, and then this, to me, the, his hand against all against him, is just saying there's going to be tension in his freedom. There will be tension, but not necessarily servitude.
Is that the same type of words used with Jake Gyllenhaal? Or is that a different?
No.
No, just different.
No. Okay. I mean, they do fit the model pretty well.
Yeah. But I don't know about that. So. You will always be, you know, in conflict with each other kind of theme, but it's using the same kind of vocabulary there.
Yeah, I don't see that.
Okay.
Again, naming God as the God who sees me. Again, for that is zedekah, right? That is seeing the dignity of someone else. And again, that he is, it's just showing the character of God that this Egyptian slave girl, to some degree an outsider, that God sees. And I think there's comfort for us in that. Rick?
So in verse 13, she calls on Yahweh, the one who's speaking to her. Is that a Christophany? She's talking to the angel and calls him Yahweh.
Yeah, so a couple of schools of thought on that is some will say that this messenger of God, this angel of God that we see throughout the Old Testament that often appears in physical form is often Christ, seen as Christ, because Christ eventually comes in the flesh, and that this is Christ as God visible. And there is a sense within the Old Testament, within Jewish thought, of a God that is invisible and a God that is visible. Same God, not two different gods, but it's just that we recognize God as being above and invisible, and at times he manifests himself on the earth. And we'll see that in our next week. We'll see that. And so some move down and say that that is Christ. Others, this is just an angel. And I'm not sure where I would flip the coin and wind up on that. Is that good?
Good.
Okay. Again, the main point being that God sees.
So I have a question about the title of Hagar, right? So she started out a slave girl, was promoted to what, right? But then when Abram gives her back, did she get demoted as wife? Like, I mean, was that a purposeful thing? Was that really a purposeful thing in Abram or just in the narrative? I mean,
I think it's the narrative. I don't think Sarah was quite that generous. But I think the narrative is wanting us to recognize that that there was this intent that was not a good intent, but she still remained a slave girl. And I think we can look at that more when we get to the next Hagar story. I think we'll see some things there. Just this comment by Daniel Hawk: the God of creation has given life and dignity to a runaway slave. Human beings devalue and turn a deaf ear. The Lord has heard. Human beings can lower their eyes not to look upon her, but God sees. And again, I think, all I'm trying to say is, this is the God we serve. A God who hears, a God who sees. If we go back to the kind of a melody, the Tree of Knowledge. Tree of Knowledge, we had a divine direction or promise given. We had delay or tension, human anxiety. We had the serpent who was deceiving, the grasping act to secure what God had promised. Knowledge was gained through self-assertion. Their eyes were opened. The consequence, they were kicked out or exiled from the garden. But God clothed them and redirected the story. So if we, let me go there. Let me go back. So as we read this story with that little cue, look at some of what the author has done. So Sarah took that which was forbidden and gave it to her husband. Her husband listened to her voice, and they did what was good in their eyes. So what does that story remind us of? this is a tree of knowledge story. And Scripture uses Genesis 3 in this way throughout the Old Testament and New Testament, that it becomes a model for how humans in fear will grasp and seek wisdom apart from God's wisdom. Now, Paul does, on a few occasions, look at Genesis 3 as a story of sin and death, and he highlights Adam in that role. But predominantly, the Genesis 3 narrative is this narrative right here, where we see humans grasping and an attempt to gain wisdom apart from God. And again, as we apply it here, God promised Abraham seed. Sarah remains barren. Yahweh restrained me. There's the blaming. I shall be built up by her. When she saw, their eyes were opened. Conflict and affliction. But God redirects the story. So again, just trying to see those melodies. Abraham and Sarah not acting in rebellion, but in incomplete revelation, which is how we act all the time. We don't have complete revelation. We are asked to trust, though. And they are trying to secure the promise through natural means. Ishmael's birth is through natural means, through, we could say, the flesh. It's what happens, right? Let's talk about covenant. word we don't use a lot, but we're going to see it being used here in the next chapter. A covenant is a pledged relationship. It says, I am yours, you are mine. It's a bond. It carries promises, loyalty, and responsibilities. For us, marriage is probably the most easily understood covenant within our culture, as well as adoption. A contract is more of a conditional exchange. You both sign on the lines, but there's no relationship really with a contract. A covenant is a relationship. And how the covenant fits into the triangle, again, if we try to keep the framing there, Kesed, it produces loyal love, even if that love is costly. It orders power to produce justice, protection, and accountability. It restores dignity. People are lifted up. And its aim is a durable and lasting wholeness or place where life can flourish. So that's our framing of the word covenant. For us, covenant is going to jump out predominantly because it's in blue. and makes it more visible. And again, that's one of the reasons I'm wanting you to have the kind of the translation text, is that you can color, you can kind of see how frequently it's going to be mentioned here. When Abram was 90 years and 9 years old, Yahweh was seen by Abram and said to him, "I am God Shaddai. Walk before me and be wholehearted. I set my covenant between me and you. I will make you exceedingly, exceedingly many." Abram fell on his face. God spoke with him, saying, "As for me, here, my covenant is with you, so that you will become the father of a throng of nations. No longer shall you be called Abram, exalted father. Rather, you shall be Avraham, for I will make you Avhaman Goyim, father of a throng of nations." Yahweh was seen. Again, we get this this terminology here. So this is not a vision like we had in the last chapter with the cutting of the pieces. A deep sleep fell upon Abraham at that point. So this is some kind of physical manifestation that he recognizes this is Yahweh. He says, "I am God Shaddai. Walk before me." I want to get to that first. In Exodus, when God is talking to Moses, he says, "I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob as God Shaddai. But by my name Yahweh, I was not known to them." And as we've been reading the text, we go, but gee, it sure seems like Abram called him Yahweh. So what's kind of with this? And what most think is that the patriarchs knew him as a promise maker, but they did not yet know God as a promise fulfiller through the liberation. So within the Exodus story, the name Yahweh takes on a maybe a fuller meaning or a deeper meaning as a God who liberates, not just makes promises. And when we see the term God Shaddai, some of your translations probably will say God Almighty, Mighty God, and that's just as good a guess as most scholars can think of. We really don't know what Shaddai means. But Abraham obviously did, and we can just rest in that. He says, "Walk before me and be wholehearted." This is different than Noah. This is different than Enoch. Noah and Enoch walked with God. And here the sages note that God says, "Walk before me, in front of me, and be wholehearted." Some your translations may say blameless. This is not meaning sinless. This is meaning walk in integrity, walk completely devoted to me, walk with a single heart or a single mind, walk in a relationship with me. Before, Abram was told to walk about the land, and that was really just a stroll about the land, just kind of walk about it. This is a relationship word. And what we see is that we are told the same thing. And if you look through the New Testament and just kind of mark how many times Paul says we are to walk. And this is the same the same way that it's being told to Abram, it's being told to us. Ephesians, "Therefore I, the prisoner of the Lord, implore you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling which you've been called." Colossians, "Walk in a manner worthy of the Lord." Galatians, "Walk by the Spirit." And that's what we have that Abram doesn't have. He did not have the Spirit indwelling to aid him in his walk that we have. So again, we are commanded to walk as Abram walked. We then get a lot of "I wills" from God. "I will cause you to bear fruit exceedingly. I will make nations of you. Kings will go out from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your seed after you throughout their generations as a covenant sign for the ages to be a God to you and to your seed after you. I will give to you and your seed after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan for the ages, and I will be God to them. So again, we're seeing the word covenant, we're seeing the word seed, and we're seeing God committing himself as far as what he's going to do. So the promise that we had in the prior chapter with the cutting of the covenant, the cutting of the pieces, we said, what is Abraham's obligation? At that point in time, Abraham's obligation was trust. Abraham trusted God. So Abraham was to walk in trust. Now we see it kind of a little bit more added on to that covenant. Walk before me wholeheartedly, single-mindedly, in complete devotion to me. That's your obligation on the covenant. Part of my obligation is to make a nation, establish kings, give you this land. And we see some of your versions may say, I'm giving you the land forever. And we kind of work through that. That's a question for us today a lot. We deal with this, well, does Israel have a right to the land? And that's our modern day question with the nation of Israel. One thing that we should note is that the promise of land and the promise of living in the land are two different things. Because God says, Leviticus, you shall keep my statutes and my judgments and do them so that the land to which I am bringing you to inhabit will not vomit you out. So there appears to be a condition on Israel being able to live in the land, and that is to do what God says. 1 Kings, but indeed, if your sons turn away from following me and do not keep the commandments, statutes I've set before you, if you go off to serve and worship other gods, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them, and I will banish from my presence this temple that I've sanctified. So we see God saying, yeah, I'm giving you the land, but there's an obligation on your part to follow me. And if you don't, the people before you got kicked out, I can kick you out too. And the reason I can do that, the land must not be sold permanently because it's mine. Well, God says, I really am claiming ownership of the land. I'm just letting you live here. And I'm giving you a place for your nation, but please recognize there's an obligation on your part if you want to remain living here. God said to Abram, verse 9, as for you, you are to keep my covenant, you and your seed after you throughout generations. This is my covenant which you are to keep between me and you and your seed after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, so that it may be a sign of the covenant between me and you. At 8 days old, every male among you shall be circumcised throughout your generations, whether houseborn or bought with money from any foreigner who is not your seed. Circumcised, yes, circumcised shall be your houseborn, your money bought, so that my covenant may be in your flesh as a covenant for the ages. But a foreskin male who does not have the foreskin of his flesh circumcised, that person shall be cut off from his kinspeople. He has violated my covenant. Abram's told to keep the covenant. We're getting, again, a little bit more information on this. Do you recall where we've seen keep before? Where have we seen keep before?
Brother's keeper.
That's one place. And before that, what was Adam to do to the garden?
Keep the garden.
Just to keep the garden. So we've got a similar charge that was given to Adam. Adam was to keep the garden. Cain asked, am I my brother's keeper? And now we've got Abraham charged with a similar vocation. He is to keep the covenant. So circumcision is a way to keep the covenant, to guard it, and circumcision also becomes a sign of the covenant, a symbol of the covenant. And this is the charge given to Abraham, and again, to his seed. So it is important that we recognize that, again, that circumcision is really performing two things. It is how they guard this covenant between God and Israel, and as a sign. It is a covenant sign because the promise concerns the seed and the future. By marking the organ of generation, God declares that the future belongs to him, not to human strategy. The covenant advances through trust and vulnerability, not control. Circumcision is a cutting, in effect, another cutting of the covenant symbol. Israel is identified as belonging to God. Again, Deuteronomy 32 language, where God exiled or disinherited the nations at Babel, but he chooses Israel as his inheritance. And we see that if you do not allow the cutting at 8 days old, you will be cut off from your people. So there's going to be a cutting. And the 8 days old, again, we've may have heard medical reasons for that, but really the eighth day is a start of a new cycle. How long did Genesis 1 take?
7 days.
So the eighth day starts a new cycle. And we see in Leviticus, you cannot sacrifice an animal that's less than 8 days old. So we have this eighth day here. And that is different from other cultures. Other cultures practice circumcision, but it was generally more at puberty, not at 8 days old. And if you remember Paul will claim his Hebrew heritage, and he'll say what? I was circumcised on the eighth day. So Paul is saying, man, I'm not just a Hebrew. I'm circumcised the way it was.
Well, you know, Ishmael was circumcised at 13, so that was kind of outside the box a little bit. But my bigger question is...
No, Ishmael was circumcised at 13.
At 13.
So that because and Abraham's 99.
Right, it hadn't existed yet. So the question is about the seed of Abraham and how it's defined. Because here, is circumcision a sign of the seed because it's people that are bought to be circumcised?
Circumcision is a sign of the covenant, not the seed. So what we see is this narrowing, and we're always going to see a narrowing of the covenant line. So Abraham is chosen, not Nahor, not Haran, not his brothers. And then Abraham is blessed, and his seed is blessed. Ishmael is one of those seed. And we see Ishmael being blessed. But Ishmael is not of the covenant line. The covenant line will be Isaac. And Isaac will be the first of the covenant line circumcised on the eighth day. And that's where he begins that covenant line. So we see Abraham and the blessing to his seed, but we also see the covenant line narrow down into Isaac.
But can we see ourselves as a seed of Abraham?
We can. We'll be getting there, but yes, that is, in essence, the basis of the class, is that we are Abraham's seed of the covenant line. A few minutes left here. So God said to Abraham, as for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her Sarah, you shall call her Sarah. It goes from my princess, which is kind of a possessive name, to just princess. Why would it go to not a possessive name, Abraham? She's not just yours. I will bless her. I will give you a son from her. I will bless her so that she becomes nations. Kings of people shall come from her. Abraham flung himself on the face and laughed. He said in his heart to a 100-year-old man, shall children be born, or 90-year-old Sarah? God extends his blessing to Sarah, and now we have the revelation complete. Abraham, it's not just you. It's going to be Sarah also. And Abraham accepts that without any reservation. And no, he laughs. And again, we see this phrase, kings will come from you. This repetition of phrase here. What about Ishmael? If only Ishmael might live in your favor, God said, nah, okay, but listen. He repeats the promise. Sarah, your wife, is to bear a son. You shall call his name Yitzhak. He laughs. I will establish my covenant with him as a covenant for the ages, for his seed after him. As for Ishmael, I hear. So he goes, and if you can see the play on words here. As for your son named God hears you, is kind of the play there. Here, I will make him blessed. I will make him bear fruit. I will make him many. And I will make him a great nation. But it is Sarah that will bear the covenant seed. Finally, the covenant pieces are in place. My covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you at this time in another year. And then we see the culmination of the chapter with the circumcision. Very quickly, some see Genesis 17 as a chiasm. Remember, we've talked about a chiasm being a literary tool that kind of starts on the edges and then works its way to a center point, and the center point being the circumcision commandment there. As it relates to baptism, in Colossians 2, Paul writes, in him you were circumcised, a circumcision not made by hands, in the stripping off of your body of the flesh, in the circumcision that belongs to the Messiah, and you were buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith, working in the working of God, the one who raised him from the dead. Circumcision is an identity marker that is both publicly marked who belongs to God's covenant people. It is an embodiment, both insistent covenant belonging is lived and visible. It's not merely just internal. And it is a boundary and entry function. Both function as initiation markers into the covenant community. Paul is arguing against Gentile circumcision as others were trying to include it for household membership. But what he is doing is saying that the circumcision that we have as Gentiles is not one that is by hands, but it is one that God has made. And it gives us that identity marker. It gives us, it doesn't give us that access, but it confirms our access. If circumcision is a formation marker, then kesed means you belong to a covenant household. You are claimed and carried by a promise you didn't author. Under mishpat, you are under a just order. God's claim includes accountability, and the sign confronts an I am my own stature. With Zedekiah, you are given a dignified identity and vocation to become a blessing, to protect the vulnerable, to practice righteousness and justice in public life. And in Shalom, the sign is meant to produce a durable communal wholeness, not necessarily a private badge. This is the community that we are to live in. Baptism does the same thing. Baptism is a new covenant reality. With kesed, we're received into a new family in Christ. With mishpat, we renounce the old powers, the old identity, the old flesh way. We transfer our allegiance to a new community. With Zedekiah, we are raised into a restored identity with agency, a new life that bears fruit in concrete righteousness and shalom. It's not merely inner peace, but a durable peace that shows up in reconciled relationships. So what can we do this week? If we examine our lives within the triangle, we can name our fear. What are we trying to secure by control, as we saw in Abram's life with Hagar? We can refuse a shortcut that treats people as tools. We can restore dignity where we may have diminished someone. We can practice covenant kesed by showing a loyal love. And we can offer an embodied yes to God as obedience as trust. When God said, be circumcised, what did we see? We see Abraham immediately that day taking him and his household and circumcising them. When God said, do this, Abraham said yes. So with that, we kind of get through that part. We get to a very interesting section in our next two chapters. So if you want to read ahead to 18:19, and kind of put the triangle, overlay the triangle with those chapters. They are meant to be read together. So I'll kind of give you that teaser. They're meant to be read together. We often read them in isolation. So read the two chapters together and with the triangle overlay, and we'll discuss that in a few weeks. So any final questions or comments?
Was circumcision ever used prior to this?
For other cultures?
Yeah.
Yes. Egyptians did it, but again, it was typically at puberty. I don't know of any cultures that performed it at on the eighth day.
I just wondered if it was just a totally foreign thing.
No, it would have been. Yeah, it would have been familiar, but God really repurposes it in a way that they've not experienced.
You may not be able to address this right now, but I'm just wondering how does this triangle relate to Zipporah and Moses when she all of a sudden decided that she needed to circumcise his sons?
I was wondering that too.
Well, it certainly saved Moses's head.
Yeah.
and we, you know, this is the circumcision on the eighth day was the ideal for the covenant, and we see in the wanderings that it wasn't done, and then we do have this mass circumcision before they can enter into Israel. So it was a sign of the covenant that was not consistently kept. And as far as how well was it kept on the eighth day in the Egyptian captivity, we don't get a lot of information on that.
Was Moses in violation of the triangle?
I don't know if he was in violation of the triangle or if he was, again, we've got, he's marrying someone outside, an outsider, basically, with a different custom. So it's hard to say how that was working at that time. But Zipporah is within the triangle. She performs Zedekah. She did the right action at the right time.
Barely.
Yes. There you go. Run.
Well, again, the seed of Abraham and how we can be considered that. Is there like a door? You have to be baptized, or is it just an action of faith?
I'm going to get into that pretty strongly in class 10. So I'd like to save that a little bit for class 10, but Paul does say he is going to draw that comparison and basically say to the Gentiles, we get into that relationship the same way Abraham did, and that is through faith. But it is not a stagnant faith. It is a faith that responds with Zedekah, and Zedekah is doing the right thing, doing what needs to be done. And what we see in Acts is that once people express that faith, we see them being baptized. And again, I think that is a gift that God gives us that we can hang on to if there's doubt. We can go back to that as a sign of the promise. There's other symbolism there too. That's just one of them, I think. So that's a teaser for the last class. All right, thank everybody for being here.
Thanks, Jared.